My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Stuart Archer Cohen. Stuart, welcome back to Portland. Welcome
back
to KBOO.
Thanks, Ed.
Title of your latest book is The Army of the Republic, and it's published by St. Martin's Press. Let's tell people a little bit about you. You live in Juneau, Alaska.
Yes.
So that makes you a Northwest writer, so you know, like you're in new territory.
I guess so.
Yeah. You own Invisible World, an international company dealing in wool, silk, alpaca, and cashmere in Asia and South America. So you're an international financier and businessman.
I wouldn't say financier.
Okay, yeah.
I have a very small international business.
Two novels before this, Invisible World and 17 Stone Angels, been translated into 10 languages. That's very impressive. Good for you.
Okay.
This book... Well, a couple of things occurred to me right off the bat about this book. One was, when did you become a biblical scholar?
I know. People are surprised to see the Bible in there in a book about revolution.
Mm-hmm.
But the Bible fascinates me, you know. You know, I'm Jewish, so it's sort of my tradition. You know, just like if you're Greek, probably the Iliad and the Odyssey are your tradition.
Well, they're everybody's tradition, let's hope.
Yeah. And I guess right away I saw a parallel between propaganda and the Bible, and that fascinated me. And I just feel like, you know, the Bible sort of is interconnected with our world, not to get too kind of bizarre about it, but I feel like it sort of interpenetrates our world, and all those stories of, you know, tyrants and betrayal and people striving to be good is all kind of taking place both in the text of the Bible and in the world as out. You know, the world around us.
Well, if you read the Bible as literature, it has a lot to tell us about human behavior,
which has
not changed much since the Bible was written, frankly.
Especially bad behavior.
Yes.
Bible's not really a book about so much about good behavior. It's about bad behavior just as much.
What the Christians call the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, has 613 commandments in it, and most of them are thou shalt nots. The other thing I wanted to ask you about was coastal Peruvian cuisine.
Uh-huh.
Now, that's a throwaway line in the book, but that made my eyebrows jump. Is it a real thing, or are you making this up?
No, it's a real thing. I travel quite a bit, and every year I go to 7 countries, and I would say coastal Peruvian cuisine is one of the best cuisines in the world. It used a lot of lime, a lot of fresh seafood, pickled seafood like ceviche, and it's really incredibly good, and it's not really very well known about. You don't see Peruvian restaurants here and there. You see Thai and Mexican and all that.
But, sure, yeah. So. Well, we're ready for a new taste sensation, so everybody's jaded and bored with Thai and all that stuff. So there's now you're starting to see Tibetan restaurants and Afghani restaurants. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
There have been Afghani restaurants for a while, but they're starting to come back now.
Well.
This is a book about revolution, and do you remember a TV show called Max Headroom? The thing about it was that it took place 20 minutes into the future. There's a certain feeling like that in this book. This book takes place in a not too far away future. Is that correct?
That's true. In fact, one of the problems I had writing the book was kind of keeping ahead of events. I started in about 2002, and I was thinking, oh, this is like 2012 or something. You know, it's set in the United States that's been through an economic collapse, and Americans are out of work, and they're confused, and they're angry. And that kind of came a little bit faster than I thought. And in the book, though, it's different because there's one party that controls the country, and there's this facade of elections. There's always elections, but they always win.
It sounds awfully familiar. Back in the days of the Bush administration, we were convinced that between Diebold and Karl Rove, the next election was going to be a sham anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You've projected that as the possibility and as the future history of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Are you feeling any better about it now, or?
I think we got a reprieve, but I don't think the government in the book is a corporate government that rules the country, and I think we got a reprieve, but I think if you look at recent events, I don't think we're, you know, completely in the clear yet. When you've got a bunch of corporations that are considered too big to fail, and when you've got a healthcare industry that can launch a major propaganda effort, and even to the point of, you know, indirectly sponsoring people to go and disrupt public meetings, then I think you got to face that there's still a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is when people hear fascism, they think Germany and Hitler. I think Mussolini in this case, because Italy was a corporate fascism. It was the corporations and Mussolini and a hierarchical top-down political system ruled Italy. What was good for the corporations was good for Italy and vice versa. That's really scarily where we were heading, and this book riffs on that.
Yeah, it does, definitely.
Okay, so let's now, is this book wishful thinking or is this book written in anger?
Certainly, I was pretty angry. I mean, anybody be angry, whether you're from the right or the left. A lot of people are angry about the way things have gone in the past, say, 10 years or the past 20 years in this country.
Let's go to 30.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there was a number of questions I wanted to look at. And one of them was, what is the power of the people? You know, in right and left, right, left and center, we all talk about the power of the people and, you know, guys in three-cornered hats in the American Revolution. Well, what is the power of the people? You know, Mao said that power comes from the barrel of a gun. And certainly in the book, you've got one group of characters. You've got Lando, who's this 20-something, you know, brilliant, charismatic, funny guy, urban guerrilla in Seattle, and he and his group of hacker, cracker, tree spiker types hook up with these guns and ammo ex-military guys on the outskirts of Seattle in these failed logging and farming towns, and they form the Army of the Republic. And they decide to take on the state with a campaign of bombing and assassination. So they believe, I would say, that, you know, in power comes from the barrel of a gun.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are a lot of characters in this book, but it's told in three first-person narratives, one by Lando, one by a young woman named Emily Courtright, who was, in effect, the moderate.
Yeah, yeah, she's a community organizer. And she and her group of people believe that they can organize, and through democratic methods like ballot initiatives or letter writing or then, you know, civil disobedience. There's massive demonstrations in this book that I did a huge amount of research on. And they believe that the government can be reformed, and they believe in the power of the people.
They're moral, and they think other people can be moral if given the chance.
Yeah.
What fools they are.
Well, that's one of the, well, that's one of the questions the book examines. Mm-hmm. And then on the other extreme, you have James Sands, who's this this corporate crony who's gotten basically everything he wants, he and his group. You know, he has a multi-billion-dollar corporation that privatizes bankrupt municipal water supplies. So he's a corporate predator. But he's not a monster. You know, you could look at him and say he's a good man. But as the book goes on, he's drawn deeper and deeper into this corporate conspiracy to liquidate their political opposition with everything that term implies.
Moms always have it right. They say, don't hang out with the wrong crowd. And he started hanging out with the wrong crowd. Even though he was an idealist and a bit of a demonstrator in the 60s, he's been co-opted.
Yeah, there's one line where he's talking to his security guy and he says something about how angry he was back in the 80s, protesting against, you know, the shadow government. And the guy says, sure looks a lot different when you are the shadow government. And he laughs and says, you know, don't take it so seriously, Jim. You know? So.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because what you've done in the book, among other things, is you've taken somebody like Blackwater, Halliburton, that axis of people, and you've created a shadow version of them in the book. And the thing that scares me that this book reinforces, which is probably not a good thing for me, but is that they learn every time. Because, you know, we say everything goes in cycles, but I'm beginning to think it's not a cycle anymore. Mm-hmm. Things aren't cyclical. They used to call evolution by leaps and bounds rather than a steady change. Mm-hmm. Every time we beat the right wing back, they get smarter. And the next time they come back smarter than they were before. And that's what's going on in here.
Mm-hmm. I would say the book reflects that there are incremental gains that the sort of corporate powers have been making, corporate right wing have been making since, well, Reagan. And now that they've got a huge, it's different from it was, say, in the 30s, because they have a huge media apparatus that functions 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that's really bent on making otherwise very decent people, thoughtful people, encouraging them to have horrible ideas and encouraging them to hate other people. And that didn't exist, you know, 40, 50 years ago. Even with McCarthyism, it didn't exist.
Well, I don't know. McCarthyism and the Red Scare is one of my hobby horses, and I would say that actually was worse then than it is now. It's just that they didn't have Fox News.
They didn't have a media. It was worse in the sense that they actually were destroying people and taking away their jobs and that sort of thing, and that hasn't happened here. But they didn't have a whole institution. They didn't have a vast media that was constantly propagandizing people.
Yeah. Whatever gains we made in the 60s in terms of civil rights and viewing the government that should be morally responsible instead of just strong, they've been trying to win back those gains for years and years, and they've used the oldest strategy in the book, which is divide and conquer.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you get Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh out there screaming at people to go out in the streets, it's not because they want their votes. They don't care about their votes. They just want them to be able to disrupt the process.
Yeah. Yeah, they want to intimidate people.
Yep, and that's what goes on in this book, but big time.
Uh-huh.
This is a personal matter, but there's still enough of the pacifist in me to think that political assassination is a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
For example, it's a movie kicking around the movie theaters right now, even as we speak, called the Bader-Meinhof Complex.
Uh-huh.
And the Bader-Meinhof Complex started out as a bunch of idealists and wound up as a bunch of sick murderers and kidnappers.
Right. That's a progression that happens on both sides of the equation, actually.
Yeah. Did anything about this give you pause as you were writing this? Did you say, why do I want to make these people look sympathetic?
Yeah, because they're people. I think you can't make – I tried to make everyone sympathetic because everyone is real people. And I've interviewed for this book, I interviewed former revolutionaries of the 70s in Argentina, and I interviewed former fascist policemen – well, they're still fascists – who were active in that area. And they're all people. I think if you try and put black hats on people, you don't really understand them. I don't see the book as advocating revolution. I think one of the points it makes most strongly is once you set into motion this chain of action and reaction that violent struggle does set in motion, you can't control it. Likewise, on the other side of the equation, once you set in motion a violent repression where you just say, I'm going to take the gloves, we're going to take the gloves off, and these guys are lawbreakers, and they've declared war on our society, so we're going to go after them without any kind of restrictions. Once you do that, you can't control that either.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Stuart Archer Cohen. Stuart's the author of The Army of the Republic, published by St. Martin's.
It's coming out from Picador in October 1st.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I have the hardcover. It's coming out in paperback. Picador.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
It's not like on Let's Make a Deal, door number one. It's like Picador in a bullfight, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Picador. I think that in 200 years, when we have a little perspective on this century and the century preceding, the 20th century, that some academic is going to come up with the theory of the law of unintended consequences, and that it's the most powerful force in the universe besides the thing that holds the stars together.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of what this book is about also.
Because they set things in motion and then they're out of control. But there is something else that's opposed to that is that this is also a book that, aside from unintended consequences, it's about people who have a real will to power. You know, on both sides to an extent. You know, Lando is this guy who's obsessed with saving the country, and he and his group are willing to lie, cheat, steal, and kill in order to do that. And on the other side, you have this James Sands who's like just wants to hold on to his privileges. He's built up this huge business. It's part of himself. And what you have with both sides is there's this quote from Mencius at the beginning of the book, and it says, you know, the benevolent man extends his benevolence from those he loves to those he doesn't love, and the ruthless man extends his ruthlessness from those he does not love to those he loves. And so there's this feeling of these two people who are so intent on who are ruthless essentially, and so intent on that they start out being ruthless with people they don't know and end up just trying to destroy the people that they most love.
You create a lot of archetypes here that are absolutely based on, I mean, we're living in a world of Glenn Beck, so anything is possible, but the guy I like the best is the hammer.
The hammer.
Tell us about the hammer.
Well, I actually had intended the Hammer. He's this kind of fascist guy. He's a talk show host, a radio host, a TV host. And I made him up, and he's a guy who wears a motorcycle jacket, and he really speaks to a young audience. And I had really meant him to be a caricature. I don't listen to too much, you know, right-wing radio. Once in a while, I tune into stuff like that just to kind of see what it's like. But he was meant to be a caricature. But then what I heard on the radio when I started to listen was even as bad or worse than him. And that kind of shook me up a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Michael Savage is everything that the Hammer is, mm-hmm. Without the motorcycle jacket and tattoos.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The idea that the country is going the direction you predict in this book, mm-hmm. is probably going to be very worrisome to a lot of people. And yet, by the end of the book, there's some hope. I'm not going to tread on any of your plot points in this book, but by the mm-hmm. end of the book, there is some hope.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things, I don't know, she's a device, but she's a device that I liked a lot, is Jim's wife, Anne.
Mm-hmm.
Because Anne knew him when.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about Anne.
Anne is this woman who, you know, this book is, it, you know, despite the politics, it's still very much about people. That's the base of it, because beneath all the politics, everything is personal. You know, whether you're a government crony making a deal with somebody sitting in a skybox somewhere, or whether you're an organizer like Emily saying, hey, can you put these posters up, or can you show up at this demonstration? Or whether you're, you know, a gorilla who's being hunted, who says, like, calls up and says, hey, man, you got to give me a place to stay for the night, or I'm gonna go down and bad things are going to happen. It's all intensely personal. It's all done on a human level. Anne is this woman who is married to James Sands and watches him slowly being consumed by his own ambition and by the people that he hangs out with, you know. And these things are tribal, you know. I think, and that's why the Book of Judges from the Bible is in it. It's all very tribal and, you know, very Old Testament. Like, the people you hang out with, that's kind of who sets your morals to a great degree. And so as he goes further and further into this really bad path, she begins to question it more and more, and it begins to destroy their relationship. And she ultimately has to make a choice. You know, she wants to stand by her man, but it's repellent to her.
Mm-hmm. Lando, who's one of the three main voices in this book, is the revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's not that he doesn't have misgivings. It's just mm-hmm. that he thinks this is necessary, that mm-hmm. That you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs, and mm-hmm. it's time to break a few eggs.
Uh-huh.
But he has many, many names and many, many guises. I think mm-hmm. one of the things that you've done in this book that I liked a lot was that you dissected the necessity to create false identities and to live in different realms.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you're vulnerable to anything. If you
uh-huh.
can't disappear at a moment's notice, how much research did you have to do to come up with this lattice work of false identities?
Oh, well, I have a very interesting bookshelf with books about improvised munitions and how to form a false identity, and I got a couple of those. And just doing research on the experience of like 60s, the Weather Underground in the 60s, mm-hmm. but mostly in Argentina in the 70s. And even though the technology has changed, it's still, you know, that sort of stuff still holds up.
These guys are like monkey wrenchers too. The mm-hmm. the Lando's crowd,
mm-hmm.
they're full of moral indignation,
mm-hmm.
and yet they do things that they might not have been able to do 10 years before or
mm-hmm.
5 years before because they feel compelled, I guess, or mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah. The one thing that you have to realize about Lando, and this is something I discovered, you know, in interviewing people who had been through the revolutionary experience, who had seen one fellow I talked to is he lost Fernando Vaca Narvaja, a famous Argentine revolutionary. He lost 13 family members, you know, including his wife, his brother, his sister-in-law. His father was discovered. They found his father's head in a plastic bag by the railroad tracks, and his father wasn't even politically involved, and they just did it to get back at him.
Intimidation. Yeah.
And so, but one thing, so I talked to a lot of people like that, and one thing is when you're young, you don't have that kind of self, you're not looking back. You know, Lando's 25 years old, and this is kind of the character of revolutionaries. They're usually young people. They're, you know, lawyers or social workers or college students. And so at that age, you're not 40 and looking back on life and wondering whether what you did was right. You're caught up in the moment. And that's why, I got criticized by, some reviewers because they took that as me being an advocate. But actually, that was a very careful decision. He does wonder as he goes along, God, we're killing this guy who's just a policeman. And, he's not like some corporate bigwig, but so he wonders about it as he goes through, but he's still not at the point where he's so deeply into the struggle that it's only near the end that he starts to think, maybe this was all a mistake.
Mm-hmm. We talked about this a little bit before we started recording, but I've always felt that the reason the left can't really make any traction over the years is because they're factionalized and cannibalistic, mm-hmm. and that they would rather the socialist workers would rather get one over on socialist labor than to get together and try to do things for their mutual interests. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of that in this book also. The factions each have they have such a narrow focus, mm-hmm. about what they want and how to achieve those ends, mm-hmm. that it takes a huge effort of will and persuasion just to keep them from going off in their own direction and doing things that are detrimental
totally.
To the cause.
Right.
Whereas the other side, they want to be told what to do. Please give mm-hmm. us our marching orders and we'll do it. We'll go out in the street with stupid signs. Mm-hmm. We'll call, the President of the United States Hitler, mm-hmm. Even though he's nothing like Hitler, because if that's what you want us to do, we'll do it. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure there's a question in here somewhere. Do you want to talk about that?
I think it's a mistake to characterize the entire right of center as kind of mindless drones. There certainly are people like that, and I think there's also people like that on the left, in all fairness. I think the difference is that right now, as I said, a lot of very decent people and kind people are being propagandized 24 hours a day to have a certain belief, and I think that's what we're seeing. Mm-hmm. Does the left cannibalize itself? So does the right. I mean, we got 300 million people in this country. It's just hard to get any sort of mass movement because it's hard to find something we all agree on, but that's kind of the nature of democracy. And that's Emily's challenge in the book is how do you get the right wing and the left wing and this church group and that Rotary Club, how do you get them all to show up at a demonstration and say, we want our vote back? In the book, all voting is electronic. There's no more paper ballots. And so it's like we want a paper ballot, and that's what as the book goes on, that's what they decide to unify around. But it's difficult. Also, what you said about that's one thing I learned about demonstrations. There's two huge demonstrations in this book, and the first of them is based on the Battle of Seattle, the 1999 WTO protests. And I read quite a bit about that, and I also interviewed some of the organizers. And what you saw at that was you had some people who just wanted to go down there and make a statement, and some people who wanted to be completely orderly. And then you had some people who said, like, let's break some windows and let's get it on the news and let's really make a statement. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I was intrigued about was, well, are those people right? Is breaking – if they hadn't gone down and broken any windows and there hadn't been any tear gas, then would anybody have ever heard about that issue?
I can honestly tell you that back in the 60s, these same arguments went on. And I know that back in the turn of the 20th century, when the IWW, mm-hmm. they had a wing which did damage, which threw monkey wrenches in the gears and, mm-hmm. and burned down things. It was the black cat was their symbol. Mm-hmm. This has been going on. This very argument has been going on forever and remains unresolved.
And right. Also, another thing I learned from interviewing people, from the right-wing side of the equation was you have to look at these things from both sides. For instance, we all may cheer when Greenpeace goes and interferes with some Japanese whaling ship. But how do you feel about it when a bunch of anti-abortion protesters go and blockade a clinic that provides abortions,
Moral ambiguity. It's so wonderful.
You have to look at, those tactics and say, hey, what if the other side does that?
Hey, I've been there because I used to be a pacifist. And one of the reasons I gave up being a pacifist is I couldn't reconcile it with my support for abortion. Mm-hmm. I understand, there are, when I see the abortion protesters, it gives me a little twinge because I understand that a lot of those deeply sincere people are trying to save lives. And what are you supposed to tell them? They're wrong? Of course they're not wrong. So you just have to, I mean, you can't base the argument on that. We have maybe a minute left. Failed idealism. Failed idealism is to me a major driving force in people my age and who've been through all these wars. Are you a failed idealist or are you still the idealist?
I think I'm still an idealist. I still am. I guess I've had to accept that some people never will learn. It's like Lincoln said, you can fool some of the people all of the time. And that's been hard for me to accept because I think everybody likes to think that if you just present the people with the facts, then they'll make up their mind and see it the way you do.
You are an idealist.
But I've come to accept that some people are always going to be, you know, you just can't do anything about them.
Mm-hmm. What are you working on now?
I'm working on a book now. I'm about 150 pages into the rough draft. It's a book about, it's hard to explain. It's not political. It's not about right and wrong. I'm really tired of right and wrong. And it's about, part of it is about these fugitive American financiers who are living very large in Shanghai. And part of it's about this faded rock star in LA who's lost all his money. And there's a 90-year-old assassin in there and a woman who lives in an ancient Chinese garden. And there's a guy who owns a hardware store in Alaska. So it's hard to explain, but that's what I'm working on.
I'm just the mental image of a 90-year-old assassin is getting to me. I'm starting to think of the comic possibilities of that character.
He's based on a friend of mine.
It's always fun to talk to you, Stuart.
Thanks, Ed.
Let me remind people, again, I have the hardcover, but it's the Picador. Is doing the – and when
coming
will
out October 1st.
October 1st. And the title of the book is The Army of the Republic, not dissimilar from the Grand Army of the Republic, which is the last moral army we had in this country, I suppose. And Stuart Archer Cohen is the author.
And my website is stuartarchercohen.com.
First name S-T-U-A-R-T.
Yes.
Yeah, like the English kings or the Scottish kings. Yes. Okay. Please come back with your next book.
Okay, thanks, Ed. Thank you.